talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning and welcome to We Are Movie Geeks Podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And it is December 21st, and it is the morning after my annual Christmas party. All the geeks were there. You guys have fun?
Were.
Oh, yeah. About to go to that Poseidon Adventure song. There's got to be a morning after.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
Nice one, Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lovely time.
Well, thank you. All the hardcores stay late and watch a movie. Last year we watched Turkish Star Wars. And didn't we watch the Japanese Spider-Man?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, the Japanese Spider-Man TV show.
Last night we watched X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes, and the Mexican Santa Claus from 1960, where he battles Satan, which looks glorious on Blu-ray.
Yeah, as I say, both the colors are really popping on that X, the Man with the X-Ray Eyes Blu-ray, I must say.
So I don't know who picked those, but that's always a way to end our party.
Good selections.
Uh-huh. All right, speaking of Turkish Star Wars, how about the Hollywood Star Wars? I think that may have come in number one. I'm not sure. Michelle, why don't you talk about the top 12 at the box offices?
Yes, here are the weekend's box office estimates from our friends over at Rentrak. J.J. Abrams' Star Wars The Force Awakens was number one, brought in an estimated $238 million in ticket sales.
Wow.
Giving it the biggest North American opening weekend ever. Disney's movie had a $517 million debut, the second biggest global opening ever since, or behind Jurassic World. Episode 7 will have the third biggest international debut of all time.
How much behind Jurassic World was it?
I don't have those numbers, but I believe it wasn't a whole lot. But
$1.37.
Yeah, probably.
Huh.
So, yeah, and that's globally, but still, yeah, Star Wars.
It's playing, 4,100 screens?
Oh, good heavens.
In the U.S.?
Oh, yeah.
That's got to be a record, I would think.
You can't swing a Wookiee without hitting a theater running Star Wars these days.
My word.
I guess they wanted to accommodate everyone who wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like they did, yeah.
Oh, and I'll talk later on about all the records it broke. Disney sent us all the stats on this record, that record. I mean,
In 1977, Star Wars was only showing at the Creve Coeur. I mean, it was probably shown in a few other theaters.
Well, did it open on the May 25th at the Creve Coeur?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was 4 years ago. But
but very limited.
But it was all, every show was sold out. And,
word traveled quickly about that film. I was like, this is something you need to see.
Yeah, that was the old Creve Coeur, though, not the current Creve Coeur. Okay. Although it was more or less in the same spot.
Yeah, it was only playing in downtown Chicago at the Esquire Theater, and the the lines, spread like wildfire.
There you go.
The tales of that film.
Hmm. Yeah, this was The Force Awakens was the fastest film to reach 100 million.
Yeah, but Alvin and the Chipmunks was right on its tail, right?
Oh. At number two is Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Road Chip.
Yes, which I gave 1 out of 5 stars in my stellar review at WeAreMovieGeeks.com.
At least you reviewed it. I've had a lot of critics.
Yeah, I was the only one in the St. Louis Film Critics Association that reviewed Alvin and the Chipmunks, so I should get some kind of special prize.
Yeah.
Really? A combination, a medal of bravery.
20th Century Fox's Family Offering took in $14.4 million, making it the lowest opening for the billion-dollar franchise. The Tina Fey, Amy Poehler comedy Sisters was number 3 at $13.4 million. Their previous film, Baby Mama, opened in 2008 to $17.4 million. Sisters cost an estimated $30 million to make. At number 4 is The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 at $5.7 million. The blockbuster franchise has made to date $595 million. Globally, Creed was number 5 with 5.1 million.
It's holding pretty strong there.
It is.
Being number 5 after about, 3 weeks of release, something like that?
Fantastic. Yeah. Combined with the 87.9 million it's already made here in the U.S., its worldwide total stands at 95 million. Coming in at number 6 is Disney's The Good Dinosaur with 4.2 million. Universal's Krampus, number 7, with $3.8 million. Worldwide, it's brought in $47.6 million. Delightful film.
Yeah. Pretty strong.
Everybody needs to see it.
And it beat In the Heart of the Sea. That's kind of sad.
It did.
For Opie Cunningham, but anyway.
At number 8, In the Heart of the Sea from Warner Brothers Pictures, $3.5 million. Number 9 and 10.
Dilwally.
Dilwally, $1.9 million. Yeah. And...
Bajiro Mastani.
Thank you.
I thought Bajiro Mastani would do a little better than that.
$1.7 million at the number 10 spot. Number 11 was Spotlight from Open Road Pictures, $1.5 million. And rounding out the 12 is Spectre with $1.4 million. Globally, the film has brought in $836
million.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
In the Oscar contender field, Paramount held The Big Short steady in 8 theaters, making... $350,000. The financial crisis comedy has earned $1.3 million since debuting last weekend, and it expands nationally on December 23rd. Sony Pictures classic Son of Saul bowed to $38,000 from 3 theaters. The Holocaust drama from Hungary is viewed as likely Best Foreign Film Academy Award nominee. So nationwide, The Big Short opens on the 23rd. Christmas Day releases are Concussion, Daddy's Home, Joy, Point Break. The Hateful Eight is playing in 100 theaters, and The Revenant is at 4. Hmm. But that's it until after the new year for openings.
Okay.
Yeah. I was going to say hooray for Bollywood.
But we'll still be back next week. So you wanted to talk about some more of Star Wars' records that are brought?
Disney sent, we posted this yesterday, they were thrilled with all the records it smashed for all-time domestic box office records. Had the biggest Thursday preview gross with $57 million. It had the biggest Friday and biggest single day gross with $120 million. The first ever film to post a single day opening of over $100 million. Biggest December debut. Nearly three times the previous record of $84.6 million. Biggest IMAX Thursday night preview at $5.7 million. Single day, $14 million on Friday, and the weekend of $30.1 million. And this is for IMAX. And it had the highest theater average for wide release at 57,000. So the force is strong with critics and audiences whose enthusiastic reactions have powered a 95% Rotten Tomatoes score and an excellent A cinema score. With an A-plus among women and younger audiences. So, Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Wow. I'm going to play the Star Wars music behind you when I edit this thing.
that's another great thing to hear, that John Williams sweeping score.
And you know something that was funny about that is John Williams, you know, of course, was going to, you know, score the film. But J.J. Abrams, usual composer that, you know, Michael Giacchino, he has a cameo in this.
Oh, yeah.
So he kind of was still in,
Well, we've heard stories that it's been confirmed about the other cameo.
I just thought...
I heard Mark Hamill has a cameo in it, too.
Well, we won't say.
All right.
I just thought that was nice. You know,
we've all seen Star Wars. Michelle's seen it twice.
Yes,
I've only seen it once so far.
Geeky.
Yeah.
All right, well, we got a bunch of movies to review, so let's get started. See, I reviewed Alvin and the Chipmunks last week. It's pretty lousy.
Let's move on.
Never talk about that movie again.
Until the next one.
Yeah, really. Let's talk about Sisters. Sisters starred Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and was number three at the box office.
Yeah,
and
Jim
reviewed it. What'd you give it, 3.5?
I gave it 3.5. I was probably a little generous there. I think it's at around 68 at Rotten Tomatoes, but... Yeah.
We are looking for a yard artisan to do some work on our bushes. I bet working on other people's bushes really makes you want to whack your weeds. I was dirtier than I thought. I'm sorry. I got dirty really fast.
There's such an appealing team I mentioned in my review. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have a woman comedy team. There have been several, actual comedy teams like Laurel and Hardy and Martin Lewis, mm-hmm. and then there's been actors that seem to be paired up quite often. Currently, you could say it's probably like Seth Rogen and James Franco, or would be, you know, constitute mm-hmm. a team. You had, you know, Gene mm-hmm. Wilder, Richard Pryor, but not really in the movies. You know, not
wait a minute, you're forgetting about Reese Witherspoon and Sofia Vergara.
That's only one. It'll never happen again.
What was the name of that movie?
That was Hot Pursuit.
Hot Pursuit, there you
and
go.
It was not even lukewarm okay. pursuit, really, but. But no, I have to go back to the 30s when there was a real team. We were talking about it last night with Thelma Todd and Zazu Pitts. So this is kind of nice that they've teamed up again after about 6 or 7 years. I wish the movie was as entertaining and as fun as those two are, you know, say when they're hosting the Golden Globes or on a talk show or whatever. It's a clock set at just under 2 hours, and it doesn't need to be that long. And most comedies don't need to be over 95 or 100 minutes. I think they spend far too much time on the party shenanigans.
Oh, the party's more than half the film.
Yeah, and the property damage and all that stuff. The preparations up to it are fairly interesting. It's kind of neat since I've been following their TV careers. That Amy Poehler is playing a character not too far removed from Leslie Knope, her character from Parks and Recs, except her character and sister has just gone through a divorce, and she's even more kind of awkward with her social interactions, especially when she's trying to flirt with this hunky guy from next door who's played by Ike Barinholtz, Nurse Morgan from the TV show The Mini Project. And there's a funny sequence that introduces Amy in the film in which she decides she's going to go out and help homeless people on the street, and everyone she encounters is actually working a job at the time, and they're really insulted by it. Now, on the other hand, Tina Fey is playing sort of the anti-Liz Lemon, her character from 30 Rock. She's like an uninhibited, irresponsible, kind of like a little sex pod type character in Sisters. She's even embarrassing her teenage daughter, and she says, "How can I? Why can't I be irresponsible when you're being irresponsible? I have to look after you." And she's a beautician, but she's crashing at different people's houses. And then when they find out that their childhood home is up for sale down in Orlando, Florida, they all go down there to get their stuff out of their bedrooms. And then when they get there, they discover that it has been sold. There's a sold sign on the front, and they decide, well, we have to have one big party, free for all, type of thing, and invite all their pals from high school. Oh, I should mention their parents are Diane Wiest and James Brolin, and they're very funny. They've moved into a sort of not a swinging singles, but like a sort of a retirement complex or for older folks. But they're having a lot of fun there, so I should mention that. But it gets a little tedious. It has that 1 hour lull when things aren't just moving as they should. If you're fans of those two actresses, it's certainly worth seeing. I hope they can get a better project together. I hope this won't be the last screen teaming of them.
This is from the director who did Pitch Perfect.
Yeah, the first Pitch Perfect.
Other than that, he's done a lot of TV.
And Paul LaPelle, who actually is in the film, who's written a lot of television. I think this might be one of her first feature film writing assignments. But I think those ladies are very talented. They have a talented supporting cast. Most of the supporting cast are comic actors and Saturday Night Live veterans and a couple of current SNL players.
And Rachel Dratch shows up and sort of reprises her Debbie Downer character, which is really funny. And John Cena was actually really funny
as
the muscle-bound drug dealer. And he was really funny in Trainwreck earlier this year. Yeah. So give that guy his own comedy.
Yeah, he does a scene where he's the drug dealer named Pazuzu.
Yeah, there you go. That was funny.
Nice little film.
Yeah. I think I liked it a little less than you, but it starts out really smart, and I liked it when they were reading their diary. And Tina Fey is this sex pot, and then Amy Poehler, her whole life has been revolved around helping the less fortunate, which is kind of a funny running gag. But then once the party starts, the IQ of the film just drops, and it's just people yelling and screaming and doing drugs and climbing walls literally and falling through ceilings and swimming in paint, and it just goes on and on and on. And then they got, is it Danny Moynihan? Is that his name?
Bobby Moynihan.
He shows up, and a little of that guy goes a long way. He just keeps running through the frame, screaming and bugging his eyes out.
Well, I did enjoy how, when you first meet him, he's kind of desperate and pathetic.
Yeah.
And that's kind of amusing. Kate McKinnon from the current cast.
Yeah, she's funny as a lesbian.
Yeah, but has very little to do with it. Yeah. But they come in and they sort of get the party started. I believe the actress in it that plays the Korean manicurist, Greta Lee, Has a very funny scene with Amy Poehler where she's trying to get her to pronounce her name correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That scene went on and on and on.
Well, you know, it's one of those things, one of those rules of comedies. You do it a couple of times, it's funny. You do it two or three more times, it's not funny. You do it another couple more times, it gets funny again.
Did you see them on Saturday Night Live this past?
No, I haven't recorded, so I'm certainly going to be watching it.
Just of note, Rolling Stones, to celebrate the opening of Sisters and this, you know, women, you know, leading the film type thing, they did a retrospect, 35 years of 9 to 5.
Oh, that's right.
Go check it out. It's a really good, they were like, you know, Sisters is opening, and this is, you know.
This isn't anything close to 9 to 5.
But it's just a side note.
Yeah.
They're so smart on TV, and then they make these dumb movies. They need to find a better projects or stay on TV or something. I don't know. Let's do a quick review of Youth, which we should have reviewed last week because we didn't think it opened until Christmas Day, but apparently it opened on Friday. Yeah. But Jim has seen it.
I've seen it.
Oh, you've seen it. You guys both seen it. Why don't you guys talk about Youth for a little bit?
Yeah, did you want to talk about that first?
Go ahead. You lead
Okay. Well, this is from, I should have made crib notes on this. It's by the Italian director of The Great Beauty, which I believe, did that win the Oscar last year? Yeah. And it's got more of an English cast there. It's got Michael Caine as a retired orchestra leader, music composer. Mm-hmm. He's vacationing at this exclusive spa in the Alps, and he's meeting up with his old buddy, who's Harvey Keitel, a film director, and he's there with his writers trying to craft a new ending for this film he's working on. Mm-hmm. It's all about them, these two guys talking to each other. I guess the main sort of plot is about a representative of the Queen of England trying to persuade Michael Caine to conduct the orchestra in his most acclaimed work, Simple Song Number 3. Yep. And Caine is insisting he doesn't want to do it because his wife was the soloist on it, and since she can't perform anymore, he's not going to do it again.
So that's such a sad storyline.
That is. But there's just so much. It's
Rachel Weisz plays his daughter.
Yeah, and she's actually married to the son of Harvey Keitel.
That's a great scene.
Their marriage is breaking apart because the husband's fallen for this Madonna-like, or maybe more like a Miley Cyrus type pop singer, and they have a little music video in there, and it's all about Harvey and Michael talking about mortality and age, and observing all these kind of weird characters at the spa. One of them is played by Paul Dano, who's an actor that wants to be taken seriously, but all he's remembered is playing Mr. Robot in some action franchise.
It's great when he shows up.
There's a morbidly obese a Latin soccer star. There's a really repressed older couple, you know, and it's kind of, you know, going back and forth between these characters.
Is it good, though?
Some of them are interesting, but, you know.
Yeah, Jane Fonda, you didn't mention her.
She shows up.
Well, I don't know.
She was nominated for a Golden Globe.
How did that happen? Yeah. I don't know.
Because she's Jane Fonda.
Yeah. It's kind of a, you know, painful scene between the two of them. But I don't know. It's, to clean up the phrase, it's kind of artsy-schmartsy, you know, in spots, and you're kind of wanting it to get going. And it's always entertaining to see Michael Caine. I don't know, it seems like it's kind of spinning its wheels through most of the film and just trying to, you know, reach for, you know, highbrow stuff, but it's not.
What'd you think, Michelle?
I really liked it. I think I liked it a little more than Jim did. I kind of agreed with what Kate said in her review. The reveal of what's happened to his wife with the dementia and everything is just devastating. The song, which will probably see a Academy Award nomination, is absolutely lovely. And I really like Jane Fonda's addition, you know, when she shows up, when you find out about her character and Harvey Keitel. Mm-hmm. So I definitely recommend it.
Okay. Well, so Michelle really liked Youth, and Jim liked it a little less than that. Now we're going to review Star Wars The Force Awakens.
It's true. All of it. The dark side.
$238 million over the weekend. Michael Hafter's on the phone. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how are you guys?
Oh, we're good. Thanks.
Yeah.
You reviewed Star Wars for WeAreMovieGeeks.com, and you gave it a miserly 4 out of 5 stars.
Yeah, I did.
Explain your reasoning.
I thought it was a fair review, but I don't know. I guess you guys liked it a little bit more than I did.
It made my top 10 list. It made number 6.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But it almost made yours, it looks like.
It almost made mine. Yeah, it's one of those films that, even though it didn't make my top 10 list, I think it's an amazing film. I think it's more of a testament to how good of a year 2015 has been for film that it didn't make my top 10. You know, that I just think there's been a lot of really good films this year.
Well, yeah, and you're the biggest Star Wars geek amongst the geeks. So maybe your expectations were in a different place.
It could be a little bit of that. Yeah, I would agree. To me, one of the things I talked about in my review, and as such a big Star Wars fan, it reminded me a lot of Star Wars A New Hope, or Star Wars 1977, if we want to call it that. I liked that, you know, the callbacks or some of the familiar tone or pacing, but other times it felt like a crutch. You get this feeling like I've done this before, or I've been on this adventure, or I've seen this. Not to get into spoilers, but there's a lot of things that felt too familiar for me.
Well, I found, as somebody who's not a big Star Wars fan, I found the familiarity a strength. And maybe you were looking for some different directions.
Well, yes and no. All the advertising for the film, one of the things that I like about the film, and one of the things that they were really pushing in the advertising, is you have these new characters, and they weren't using Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher as a crutch, that they're the old generation stars, and we've got this new group of stars now, and these are going to be guiding the film. And I like that, and I think the film does a good job with that. For me, though, having those new characters in a plot that's so similar to what the old characters went through, that's where it sort of lost me. But I did actually see the film a second time last night, and it's a great fun adventure.
Have you seen it in 3D?
I saw it in 3D the first time.
Oh, that's right.
Last night I just saw it in standard projection.
I see. Which do you prefer?
The 3D is great. Oh. I actually really like the 3D.
Yeah, I'll have to see that in the 3D. I've got a comment and question, Michael. What I thought was interesting, I was thinking about this morning, is with the new characters, there's a more of a sort of inner conflict and turmoil in them with Kylo Ren, who's not a straightforward villain, and especially with John Boyega as Finn. And his story arc kind of reminded me of Lucas's first feature, THX 1138, in that he's been programmed to be this way, and he's sort of breaking free in his mind and in his actions. Did you make that connection, or did you consider that?
I didn't actually make that connection. I think that's actually really insightful, though, that like you picked up on that, because I am a fan of THX 1138. Yeah, that is interesting to me. One of the things that I really connected with is Rey, you know, having such a strong female character finally in the Star Wars universe, especially because the prequels really didn't have a strong female character, in my opinion.
Amidalia, are you kidding?
Yeah.
But the thing that I loved in terms of a story arc, I was really happy with Harrison Ford's Han Solo story arc. I think, you know, with Return of the Jedi, he's kind of pushed to the side, and you know, when you think about him from the original film to where he goes in Episode 7, I think it's a great story arc, and you even see it in the trailers when he's like, you know, it's true, all of it, you know, him coming to terms with this mystical force and the magic of the galaxy and the power of this world, and him realizing that it shows the 30-year progression between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens really well.
I was talking with a friend yesterday. We mentioned about when he came back to Indiana Jones with Crystal Skull, and his character seemed kind of mean-spirited in that. And Han Solo, he's he's got a little bit of crankiness, but he's still the coolest guy in the galaxy, and he's very nurturing and encouraging to the new characters. So that's
yeah,
nice.
He's very warm. Yeah, he's very warm, and it's you have elements of that sort of crotchety, you know, gunslinger type character that he played before, but it's also, you know, he's learned a lot over the years, and he's changed and evolved, and I like that, you know, I like that J.J. Abrams and the script that Kasdan wrote with him, it shows that time has passed. It shows that a character like that has changed, and mm-hmm. I think his story arc is really amazing.
We're going to wrap this review up, but thanks for calling in, Michael.
No, thanks for having us. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
All right, take care, guys.
All right, bye. Okay, that was Michael Hafter, who reviewed Star Wars for WeAreMovieGeeks.com, gave it 4 out of 5 stars, and he just explained why.
Yeah, I would have given it another half one.
I would have given it 5. I gave it anything in my top 10, I'm probably going to give 5 out of 5 stars.
Yeah.
And the below-the-line crew, like we talked about, John Williams, I mean, you know, him, yeah. The familiar themes, it made our top 10 film scores. I love the cinematography. It's another one of J.J. Abrams, you know, somebody he always works with, Daniel Mandel, who also did the Star Trek films. So, you know, below the line crew was just...
Who was this young actress, Ray? Have I seen her before?
I don't think so. I think maybe she's just done mostly TV, Daisy Ridley.
Right.
But yeah, seeing her on the talk shows, I was like, she reminds me so much of Keira Knightley.
Thank you. But I have to agree with Michael. I love what they did. Finally, a bit, you know, a strong female character. She totally takes over and where her story is going, and
I look forward to seeing maybe more Rey's this Halloween than Anna's and Elsa's from Frozen. Maybe she'll replace the Disney princesses.
All right, so we all like Star Wars a lot. Let's move on and talk about Concussion.
I found a disease that no one has ever seen. Repetitive head trauma chokes the brain.
The NFL does not want to talk to you.
You turned on the lights and gave their biggest boogeyman a name.
You're going to war with a corporation that owns a day of the week.
No proof was presented today because there simply isn't any.
I didn't really like all that much. Concussion stars Will Smith. Do you remember the character's name?
Oh, gosh, I should have jumped
it down. It was a guy from Africa. Nigeria, and he is a coroner, and... he concludes that concussions in the NFL over many decades have resulted in brain damage and psychosis among several players.
It's all in the Pittsburgh area.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like the Steelers.
So the NFL doesn't really like his conclusions very much, so they send some nefarious agents after him. It gets a little silly.
Yeah.
It's not a very good movie. It's not a terrible movie, but once it sort of sets up its basic premise, about halfway through, it just doesn't really know where to go. He gets, I think, sued for fraud, and then his pregnant wife is being followed around by this mysterious black car that causes her to miscarry, and it just sort of peters out.
I should single out David Morris as the tragic football player.
Yeah, he's really good.
Who's introduced in the opening scenes and kind of starts the investigation.
Yeah, his story sort of kicks off the plot. In fact, all the supporting actors are really good. Albert Brooks is really good. Alec Baldwin is really good.
And
like you say, David Morris. And Will Smith is actually really, really good. He's sort of... underplays it a bit. He's sort of low key, and he has this African accent, which he seems to do a good job with. I don't know how authentic it is, but he's certainly consistent with his accent, which is kind of a challenge for actors doing these kind of accents. I don't see it making much of a splash.
Yeah. He has his wife in Magubu Raw, I believe is her name.
Right.
She was in Belle and a couple of other films. She's very good in it.
I thought that was Kerry Washington.
No.
I did.
Well, no, but
until just now.
Glad to see that she was cast in this too.
Yeah,
she was great in Belle.
Yeah, I wish the film was stronger.
Mm. It's from Peter Landsman, who directed Parkland and who wrote Kill the Messenger.
All right, well, that's a Christmas Day movie. If you've seen everything else,
and you like Will Smith,
if you like Will Smith, we don't recommend it strongly. But I mean, there's worse movies out there. It's better than Love the Coopers. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Jim is the only one in the room who has seen Hateful Eight.
Hear this. I'm taking this woman to hang. Rewards $10,000. That money's mine, boys.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh.
My wife called in a couple weeks ago. She saw Hateful Eight before anybody, but she's special. But Jim got to go to the screening. I had tickets for John Waters at the Sheldon that night, so I missed it. It opens Christmas Day in St. Louis in 70mm over at the Ronnie's. Jim, why don't you give us a review of Hateful Eight?
Okay. This is Quentin Tarantino's eighth film, which he tells you right in the opening credits. I saw a version of it that's going to be similar to the 70mm Roadshow presentation that'll be opening this on Christmas Day this Friday.
So it's the one that opens Friday is longer, correct?
Yeah, I've heard it's a few minutes longer, and it has the intermission and the overture and all that stuff, and it wants to make you feel like you're in a showcase theater from the 1960s.
So you didn't have the intermission?
We did have the intermission. We had the overture, so we had that. So we got the longer version. We didn't have the 70mm projection, but it was similar to it. And, it's a Tarantino script through and through. It's set in the probably the 1880s in Wyoming. It's horribly cold in Wyoming. The snow's everywhere. You first see the stagecoach trying to make its way around the snow, and inside the stagecoach is hanging the hangman, John Ruth, a bounty hunter played by Kurt Russell, who has a big walrus mustache. I think he's called it his Yosemite Sam look, and he's transporting his prisoner, Daisy Domergue. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's a reference to Faith Domergue from the
1950s. I'm sure it is.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Sir, what's Quentin? So, of course.
It's Quentin.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's rented out the stagecoach to just transport her, and he's determined that he's going to bring her in alive. That's why he's called the hangman, because when he goes after somebody that's on the lam, he doesn't just bring that back the body. He's the opposite of, Major Marcus Warren, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who they see along the trail, and he has collected some bounties, but the guys are stacked up on top of each other, and he's not quite as particular, and he is able to wrangle a seat on the stagecoach with them. And they also run across a character named Chris Mannix. I think Chris is probably a reference to the Steve McQueen character from Magnificent Seven, and of course Mannix, the old Mike Connors TV detective. He's played by Walton Goggins, who was in Django Unchained, is kind of making a name for himself, and he tells them that he is going to be the sheriff of Red Rock, the town that they're headed towards. So he was able to get a ride on the stagecoach, and there's a storm coming in, a blizzard, and they can't travel too much further, so the only place to sort of wait out the storm is Minnie's Haberdashery, this sort of big log cabin type thing that's kind of a general store.
Mm-hmm.
And they're familiar with the owners there.
When they arrive at Minnie's, is that when the intermission is?
No. It's prior to the intermission. And when they get there, Minnie herself and Sweet Dave, the owners, are nowhere to be found. Instead, there's this Mexican fellow named played by Damon Bashir, who's sort of helping to run things. There also is Tim Roth and Michael Madsen as other fellows riding out the storm, along with Bruce Dern, who's this Confederate officer who's in a rocking chair by the fireplace. When Kurt Russell, John Ruth, and his gang get in there, they know something's not quite right. And so they're trying to feel out each other and kind of figure out these new people that are there. You know, Michael Madsen's an old cowpoke, and Tim Roth says that he's also going to Red Rock, that he is actually the official hangman, and so that's kind of a weird coincidence. You know, they kind of comes to a boil before the intermission, and then when you get back from the intermission, you kind of find out what has transpired prior to the arrival of the stagecoach. And
it's a flashback then?
Kind of a little bit of a flashback. Okay. It introduces the big star that now is not part of the IMDb.
But does the flashback all take place in Minnie's Haberdashery?
Yes.
So what percentage of this movie takes place in Minnie's Haberdashery?
I would say a good 2/3 of it. There's maybe about a half hour in the stagecoach or around the stagecoach. And it's basically all sort of a set piece in there. I think some people have compared it to a Western version of Clue. That's a lot bloodier. Mm. It's kind of a whodunit because
the French maid.
Yes. But John Ruth knows that these people aren't who they say they are, and at least one of them is probably working with Daisy. A little bit of 10 Little Indians is in there, the old Agatha Christie story. But it's really entertaining. It's Quentin and doing this great dialogue, and I'm sure that's what attracted all the actors. Mm-hmm. The actors are all terrific, especially Walton Goggins. He's a great new sort of discovery, a new mm-hmm. character into the Quentinverse, I guess you could call it, because all these actors have worked with Quentin before, except for Jennifer Jason Leigh, and she is quite remarkable in it. I expect to see a supporting actress nomination for her. She's mm-hmm. She's terrific as this really mean and nasty character, and you should feel sympathy for her because she's really tossed around a lot by Kurt Russell's mm-hmm. character. But she's just mean to the core.
What about Morricone's score? Is it a throwback to his spaghetti western
gorgeous.
Stuff?
Yeah. I was going to say, I think our last show, Michelle, you were surprised that I mentioned that I thought it was a contender for best soundtrack.
Yeah, but, it actually made our top 10 film scores of 2015. It's a great score. Yeah, I was listening to it over the weekend.
Did that article go up yet?
What's that, sorry?
That article about our best film scores?
Yes, that is up. Yes. That went up yesterday. Oh, okay. And Morricone's, it's going to be at the Academy Awards. It's going to be between, right now, I venture a guess, it's going to be between Morricone's score for Hateful Eight and John Williams' Force Awakens.
Hmm.
Both
veterans.
But Morricone has never won, and Williams has won many times.
So right now, I would think the front runner would be
Morricone. I haven't heard the score, but I can't wait to hear it.
It's gorgeous. I look forward to seeing it in the 70mm. It's even though it's set pretty much inside the haberdashery, it's a gorgeous-looking film. It's violent. It's bloody.
I like violence and blood.
You can expect that. You'll love the retro opening credits.
Okay.
There are occasional shots outside because the horses are all tied up in the back, and so there are a few scenes with them braving the storm. Mm-hmm. But boy, you want to get a big cup of hot cocoa going after this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very well done. A lot of racial epithets in it too. A lot of N-bombs in it.
Well, but I'm not seeing it then.
but it's pretty entertaining.
Good. So Jim highly recommends Hateful Eight, and Michelle and I can't wait to see it.
Exactly.
And finally, we need to review Joy.
I have real ambitions and real ideas.
We're making an invention, and it's very serious.
Joy's never run a business in her entire life.
It's my fault. I gave her the confidence to think she was more than just an unemployed housewife.
I don't want to end up like my family.
I have to do things myself once and for all.
Okay, Godspeed. Good luck. Here we go.
Joy is the newest from David O. Russell, and it stars his cast of his last couple films sort of reunited.
Hmm.
You've got Jennifer Lawrence, you've got Robert De Niro, and you've got Bradley Cooper all back. And this is the story of Joy Mangano, the woman who invented the Miracle Mop.
Why, yes.
And, it's a biography. It covers most of her life. There's a lot of flashbacks of her as a child, and she's divorced with a couple of kids and lives with her mom, who is played by
Virginia Madsen.
Virginia Madsen, whose brother is Michael Madsen, who was in Hateful Eight.
Yeah,
so, go see the Madsens this weekend. love the Madsens.
More than the Coopers, that's for sure.
Yeah, and... it's all about her inventing this mop, which sounds like kind of an odd subject for a film, and that's what the movie focuses on, how she got the idea to invent the mop. Her father, played by Robert De Niro, wonderfully played by Robert De Niro, I should add, is divorced and hooks up with this Italian widow played by
Isabella Rossellini. Yes.
And she's got a hunk of, a lot of money, and she owns a yacht, and so Jennifer Lawrence's Joy talks her into sort of helping to fund this mop, and then she gets on the QVC, was it?
Yeah, QVC.
Yeah, QVC, which
Quality
was...
Quality Value Channel.
Yeah, which was the early version, I guess, of the shopping network. And she has quite a bit of success eventually, but she has to go through a lot of trials and tribulations. I think it's a really good film. It's very well acted, very well written. It didn't make my top 10 list. It wasn't quite that good. But it's, David O. Russell is a great writer and a great director.
Hmm.
And this is a very interesting story. I think audiences are really going to connect to this movie. I think it's going to do well. I think especially women audiences are going to really like, the character arc that Jennifer Lawrence goes through in this film. And
they might be a little put off that there's not a romance between her and Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
There, it's not a follow-up to Silver Linings Playbook. But his character is very interesting too, as the exec at the QVC that kind of brings her in. But he's tough.
Yeah,
he's got some standards.
Yeah, he's kind of intense. And then we should mention that the the central hostess of QVC at the time was Joan Rivers, and Joan Rivers is a character in this film, and she is played by none other than Melissa Rivers, which I think was a nice touch for the producers to reach out and ask her to play her mother so soon after her mother sort of died suddenly last year. Mm-hmm. And she looks like her mother.
Yeah, she's not doing a caricature. It's a very she sounds her vocal inflections, and of course when she puts on the blonde wig, it's pretty close.
Yeah, have you seen it yet, Michelle?
I have not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it is PG-13, so this is a big change for David O. Russell. Mm-hmm. He's toned down the language, only one F bomb in this one, and it's a nice little film. I don't think it's as strong as his last three, but
I don't think it's going to be the Oscar.
I think Jennifer Lawrence will be nominated, especially if it does well. She'll have momentum.
Yeah, the best actress category this year is really tough. So yeah, I don't know, but De Niro is terrific in it. You mentioned that as Rudy, and he's really nice. Also, Elizabeth Rom, who was in American Hustle, plays Joy's half sister. Mm-hmm. She's sometimes nasty. Supportive, and other times she's going to stab her in the back, and it's a very, very interesting character. Hmm. So it's really a very, very well done, but it's kind of David O. Russell light. I've heard people call it.
All right. So who's reviewing that?
I am reviewing.
Jim will be reviewing Joy. Look for Jim's review of Joy Thursday night at WeirdMovieGeeks.com. Oh, Carol. We still need to review Carol.
Oh.
Oh, we haven't reviewed Carol. I saw that way back at the St. Louis International Film Festival. That is the latest from Todd Haynes,
who sort of
made a career out of making films about being gay in a less tolerant time. And Carol is certainly no exception. It's about a lesbian romance in Manhattan in the early 1950s. It stars Cate Blanchett, who is absolutely magnificent in the title role. And Rumi Mara is her love interest. Rumi Mara has a slightly less challenging role, though she's really good too. But Cate really goes through a whole range of emotions in this film. And I mentioned this before, but we can't leave out these two actors. Kyle Chandler and Jake Lacy, who play the men in both of their lives. They're just as important to this story as Anne Hathaway and Michelle Williams were in Brokeback Mountain, and they got a lot of acclaim, so let's not leave these guys out. But it's a really good, sort of a simple story. These two women want to be in love, and they can't. And this woman, Kyle Chandler, as her husband, threatens to take away custody of their child. And they go on this road trip, and it doesn't end well. Yeah. The road trip doesn't end well.
Yeah, well, it's a gorgeous-looking film, I tell you. The cinematography, the sets, the costuming, the fashions, the hairstyles. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful
really nice.
Score from Carter Burwell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very, very well done.
Yeah, it's an interesting-looking film. It's sort of grainy. It has a sort of a throwback to some of the film stock they may have used back in the 50s with the sort of saturated colors and overly grainy.
Far From Heaven. Yeah. I mean, Far From Heaven, the reds permeated the screen.
Yeah, and Haynes?
Todd Haynes.
He has an interesting way of framing the characters in a lot of scenes.
He really does.
He would rather, not necessarily show the person talking, but show, the other person reacting and kind of, it's very, very artistic.
He lets each scene go seconds longer than most directors. Would so that you really are into the emotions of the scene. And
Carol's a great movie. Made my top 10 list. Did you make your top 10 list, Michelle?
Yeah, no, I do have a top 10 list. I believe so.
Okay. Did you make yours, Jim?
Top 20, maybe.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. All right. So we highly recommend Carol. Opens Christmas Day everywhere. Now we will be reviewing Carol. Look for my review of Carol Thursday night at WeirdMovieGeeks.com. The only other movie that opens Friday is Point Break, which we have not seen. So maybe next Monday we can talk about Point Break if we have seen it by then. The St. Louis Film Critics Association, of which Jim and I are members, released their awards. Jim, what?
It was pretty evenly distributed. There were three films that each scored three wins each. The big winner, I guess, would be Spotlight, which was our pick for Best Picture. Also, I believe it was Best Original Screenplay and Best Director.
Which Todd I can't believe. Are you sure Steve Harvey didn't like to announce the wrong... winner on that. I cannot believe that one.
What
Best Director. And I mean, that's a movie that loses nothing when it goes to the small screen.
Well, you know, those actors had to have some direction. Well, of course, of course. Doing, you know,
but you know, every TV show has a director that directs the actors. That's not saying much. I thought it was directed with very little, cinematic style.
Well, you know, the Oscars can't tell you the runners-up, but it was almost George Miller.
Well, it should have been George Miller, damn it.
Yeah, it was between George Miller and Inuratu, I believe. So, the other one with three wins is The Revenant, which won Best Actor for Leonardo DiCaprio, Best Cinematography, and it is gorgeously shot, and Best Scene. That's unique to the St. Louis Film Critics. We pick out a sequence or scene from a film, and it's Leo, when Leo met Judy, Judy the Bear.
Judy
and
the Bear. I didn't know the bear had a name.
Yeah. According to Entertainment Weekly, they named the bear. And the other one with three wins is Mad Max, one of our favorites. I believe it won for best editing, best art direction, and best
visual effects.
Uh-huh. Yes, terrific stuff. Other individual winners, we gave best actress to Brie Larson for her terrific performance in Room. One of our faves, Alicia Vikander, the It Girl of the Year, gave for supporting actress for Ex Machina. Supporting actor, another old favorite, Sly Stallone for Creed. Very, very nice. Now, talk about runners-up. It was almost Ian McKellen for Best Actor, so a close one.
I hope he gets an Oscar.
We also have some other categories. Best Animated Feature, it was almost a landslide for Inside Out.
I didn't vote for Inside Out. I voted for Anomalisa.
There was
one. And so did Diane. She said she voted for Anomalisa for Best Animated Film, too.
Okay. Yeah, well, there was also a vote for Peanuts and a vote for The Good Dinosaur, strangely enough. Best Comedy, pretty much a sweep for Trainwreck, with the runner-up being Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which is very, very odd.
Yeah, I turned that in as my number one worst film of 2015.
Well, the worst film from the St. Louis Film Critics is going to be making a lot of lists. Fantastic Four.
Yeah, that's too easy of a target. That's just a boring film.
It's just incompetently done film, and it takes terrific source material and squanders it. Yeah. So, you know, it's deserving, I think.
What were the runners-up on that?
I think it was closely followed by Aloha, Love the Coopers, and then with one vote each was Jupiter Ascending and the Lazarus Effect.
Though Jupiter Ascending wasn't that bad.
It was pretty
cheesy.
Yeah.
But I it wasn't boring. I thought it was kind of fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a couple of films I put ahead of those in the worst category. Yeah. But we'll be talking about those in January, probably.
Yeah, we'll come back and talk about the We Are Movie Geeks worst movies of the year. So, all right. So, Spotlight, one picture and director.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. Well.
I think that's how a lot of the critics groups are going.
Well, I know that one of the groups said Carol, and I think National Board of Review, it was Mad Max.
I don't think anybody's given the director of Spotlight Best Director, though. Mm-hmm. Except St. Louis. I guess we're trendsetters.
It was a close one.
All right. What else can we talk about? Oh, Michelle got to see Ride Along too. I assume you can't review that.
It's hilarious. It's funny. I like that it's starting to set itself up as a franchise.
Yeah. But that's a 2016.
That
release.
Is in January, and that's coming out the same weekend as the Benghazi 13 Hours of Benghazi.
But you got to hang out and party and drink and go out to eat with the stars of the film.
Some stupid beats.
Ice Cube and Kevin Hart were here in St. Louis part of the nationwide tour. So St. Louis is one of their stops to promote the sequel. It's directed by Tim Story. And so they were here on Thursday. They held a special screening for the fans. They met Ozzie Smith. They visited Anheuser-Busch. They saw the Arch. They were on Instagram. Everything that they did was on their Instagram pages. Yeah. And we talked about what they thought of St. Louis Emo's Pizza. Which didn't sound like they were big fans.
No.
They didn't think it was the square beyond compare?
No. Emo's Pizza's lousy, I think.
Well, and Kevin Hart
Jimmy Kimmel.
Kevin Hart was just here over the summer with his comedy stand-up.
I interviewed Kevin Hart for WeirdMovieGeeks.com a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you did.
For, was it Think Like a Man or something like that?
Yeah, one of those, yeah.
Yeah.
He also had Steve Harvey.
They
based on his book.
Both were...
Kevin Hart's a little guy, isn't he?
He is. We caught up with them on Friday morning as they were getting ready to jet out. So we were part of, We Are Movie Geeks was part of a select few invited to interview them with a small round table on Friday morning. So it was great. We talked about what they did, and the two couldn't have been more, you know, they were very gracious, really nice, just lovely to talk to. So we got in a few questions before they left.
Did I hope everyone mentioned how much they enjoyed Straight Outta Compton to Ice Cube?
We did. We talked about Compton a little bit. Yes. We also talked about his their induction, NWA's induction into the music, the Rock and Roll Hall.
And a Barbershop 3.
Come on. But yeah,
no,
there's,
no. There's a Barbershop
3. There's one. Yeah,
the first movie opened, you know, was just this great box office success, and I think this one will be too.
Ride Along 2.
Ride Along 2 from Universal Pictures. So yeah, no, it was great. They we were able to talk to them, and then they took off for their next stop. But the screening, you know, people were crazy at the screening, and
did absolutely. They talk before the screening?
They did. Oh, they did just a little bit, just to introduce the film.
So a little red carpet stuff there. Yeah.
All right. So Michelle got to meet Ice Cube and Kevin Hart.
The lucky girl.
So look for, I guess you'll be posting a transcript of that interview at WeAreMovieGeeks.com later this week.
Coming up the week the film opens.
Okay.
Middle of January.
Awesome. Something to look forward to. Okay. So what else can we talk about? We got a few more minutes here. Michelle, you said you saw some great documentary, a true crime documentary on Netflix.
It's the whole thing with Netflix and how they're releasing movies day and date that they're showing it, like Beasts of No Nations. This one,
What's it called?
Making of a Murderer.
Oh yeah.
It's was filmed over 10-year period. Unprecedented real life thriller about Stephen Avery, a DNA exoneree who, while in the midst of exposing corruption in local law enforcement, finds himself the prime suspect in a grisly new crime. The way it's
revealed, was locked up.
Yeah, the way it's revealed, I wouldn't give away. I highly recommend it. Wouldn't give away any of the plot points, but definitely see it. It's gripping. You just sit there watching it. And I don't care how you're watching it, which platform from Netflix, but it just you're just left. You can't move after it's over with.
He's probably guilty of something. I mean, that's what I say about all these guys that get exonerated.
Was it Clint Eastwood and The Infinite? We all got it coming, kid.
Yeah.
But it's another really fine example of what Netflix is doing and accomplishing. And
well, didn't they do that recently with the Adam Sandler Ridiculous 6 film? Mm-hmm. Did that go day and day?
Yeah, that's
that
The Cobbler.
Yeah.
The Cobbler went straight to Netflix.
From Todd McCarthy.
Which disqualifies him from the Oscar right there.
Robert De Niro and Nicolas Cage, their recent movies opened, you know, in limited release theatrically, but it also had a big video on demand in Netflix. So I think that's just becoming just almost the norm. I don't know about the really big films yet.
I don't think they'll ever do that with the next Star Wars film. No. Certainly not.
And I mean, films are definitely meant to be seen in the cinemas, but, you know... If you can't get out,
it's got Robert De Niro and Nicolas Cage.
No.
Oh boy,
two separate.
Okay.
I was going to say, I'm sure
the two men who cannot turn down a script.
Like they called Reggie Jackson Mr. October in baseball. Yeah. We could call Nicolas Cage Mr. January for movies. I'm sure we'll have a couple of his films opening after the first of the year.
All right, so we did lose an actress, not a super well known actress, but kind of a cult actress, Phyllis Davis, who was in Russ Meyer's Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And a terrific women's prison movie called Sweet Sugar, and also a really unusual prison film, sort of an island prison film called Terminal Island with Tom Selleck and Marta Kristen from Lost in Space. Just a gorgeous woman. And Jim, you were a fan of her from television.
Yeah, I guess she's I first encountered her as one of the repertory players along with Stuart Margolin on Love American Style, the little blackout skits that they do in between the segments. And she was a brunette then, and then she went blonde for the show Vegas with Robert Urich in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think she appeared on Magnum P.I. a couple of times, got a reunion with Selleck. And terrific, gorgeous actress.
Gorgeous. And often appeared nude in these films that I mentioned. And a gorgeous figure on that woman.
Yeah.
So RIP to Phyllis Davis, and I guess we're going to have to say RIP to this week's show because we run out of time. Next week we can review Point Break if we've seen it, and we are going to talk about the We Are Movie Geeks top 10 movies of 2015, so you don't want to miss that. All right, so for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And listen again next week.
Black leather, rock. Christ, Dave. Hello, darling.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.